morning. Thanks for joining us here in this space today. I think we're ready to get going. So thanks for joining us as we continue our journey with this topic, this Lenten theme of theology of death. Thanks to Lou last week for reflecting on what he's learned at Mary's Woods about life and death. As we go through this, and as you hear things and as you reflect on things, just a reminder, if questions come up that that you don't want to just raise your hands and ask right in the middle, though of course, as always, feel free to do that. You guys are never shy to do that, so I don't even need to say that, but you know, feel free at any moment to raise your hand and ask a question. But if questions come up that you're just thinking about, please do record them, because on the 31st, when we sort of wrap up what we've heard and what we've learned, I'm hopeful that we can return to that and reflect on some of those questions. We took questions, we fielded them the first day, and then since then, just want to encourage you, hold on to your questions, anything that this brings up, and then let's reflect on them together on the 31st. By the way, I say the 31st, which is not next week, because next week, and let me encourage you to attend for this, we're going to hear an interview with Bill's friend from Oklahoma, Todd Mead. They have this long history together. Todd Mead has, he's in the end stages of life with his cancer, with the brain tumor. And so he and Bill recorded an interview together. And you will definitely want to be here to hear that as we switch back and forth into sort of theology and story and theology and story. So that will be story next week, filled, of course, with theology. So please be here for that. Here are the two lines we've started each class with so far as we've reflected on a theology of death. The first, from Psalm 48 and verse 14, just this reminder that as we reflect on these issues, we recognize death is a difficult thing to talk about, particularly in our day, in our age, in our time, in our place in this world. Death is difficult. It brings up difficult things. And so before we even say a thing about it, we want to start with this. Our promise that God is our God forever and ever, God will be our guide even through death. That whatever we're talking about, whatever we're trying to understand theologically here, we know this. God's presence will not leave. That we know. And then second, this really interesting statement from Saint Benedict in the 6th century, where he writes a little instruction book for those monks who've headed out into the desert to reinvigorate church life, to reimagine what it can be disassociated from empire just a bit. He goes out in the desert. He writes this rule. It's called the Rule of Saint Benedict that the monks follow. And rule number 13 or 14 or something is this one line: keep death daily before your eyes. That is his admonition. And Christians have held on to that for all these years since then. Keep death daily before your eyes. Why would he have said that? That's one of the questions I hope to return to on the 31st when we sort of wrap up. Why did he say that, and what's the good of it for us? Okay, with that said, as a sort of in between what we did in the previous class on March 3rd, not when Lewis shared his story, but before that, on March 3rd, a tie into that class and today's class, let me give you two more quotations. These are the ones we always begin with, but let me give you two more. The first one comes from Genesis 3, verse 4. These are the words of the serpent to Adam and Eve. The very first promise and word from Satan is this: you certainly will not die. Which, of course, turned out to be a lie. But nevertheless, his first words. And second, from Philippians 1, 21 and 23, the Apostle Paul writes this. For to me, he says, as he's writing to the church in Philippi, for to me, living is Christ And do you remember how that verse ends? For me, living is Christ and dying is gain. What an extraordinary thing for a man to say. For to me, living is Christ and dying is gain. And then he goes on, I'm actually hard pressed between the two, living and dying. My desire is to depart and be with Christ because, as he says, for that is far better. Our question is this. Why would these two beings say these two statements? Why would Satan lie about death? And why would Paul look forward to it with what we can only call eagerness? Well, our class 2 weeks ago on March 3rd, to some degree, answered that first question. Our class today will attempt to answer the second question related to that second verse. So, as we begin, let me give you just a brief summary of the March 3rd class. As a reminder, it lasted for 61 minutes. We went over by 1 minute, and we were moving at quite a pace. It was a sprint for 61 minutes. So there was a lot that we said. But let me see if I can just give you just a brief summary. On March 3rd, our questions were this regarding the theology of death. We wanted to know, number one, what is death? What do we even mean when we use that word? And secondly, why is death? Why is there death in the first place? What and why? So, without too much commentary, here's what we said. Again, the third was fast-paced. This summary is going to be fast-paced. But just to sort of get us into it, here's what we said that day. We said this: we are made for life. Again, I'm not going to comment on all these. We spent a ton of time on them on the third. But we are made for life. Secondly, life is for communion. By the word communion, you can think in terms of relationship. Something like that. Communion with God. Relationship with God. Communion with one another, whether humans or the non-human creation. Communion with yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. We were made for communion. So we're made for life. Life is communion. All of that set up this. Death, therefore, as we discovered, as we looked at scripture and Christian history and thought, death is a relationship to life and communion. The way to understand death, again, not everyone does it this way. You could do it in the other direction. You could understand life by first starting with death. But what Christians do is they begin with life in order to then understand what death must be all about. Death is a relationship to life, to communion. And what we said was this. One of the biggest problems when trying to understand death is presuming that death means one thing. When, in fact, in Christian history and in Christian theology, death means at least three things. One, death is a consequence. This is like Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. Death is a consequence. It's what happens when we live other than we were created to live. We also spoke about death as a commitment. This was like Mark 8. Jesus says to the crowds, if any wish to come after me, let them deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. For those who lose their life, who commit to that, losing their life will actually save it. So death can be a consequence, death can be a commitment, and to stick with the letter C, death is consummation, fulfillment, completion. Philippians 3:21, Christ will transform us, our humble bodies, into his glorious bodies. 1 Corinthians 15:51, we will all be changed. And so, what we said about this is that there are three different relationships that death has to life. Death is consequence, is something like the end of communion. Every time communion ends, life ends. Life is communion. The thing we fear most about death is that we don't get to be with the person we were in communion with before. We don't get to be with our children. We don't get to be with our parents. That communion ends. Death is consequence is the end of communion. Death is commitment. Death is commitment is like the repair of communion. It's dying to those things that inhibit communion. So you repair the relationship of communion. So I die to my pride so I can actually be a better husband, right? I die to my arrogance so I can be a better father. You know, things like that. I die to something to repair communion. That's, again, a second type of death. And then death is commitment. Death is commitment is the fullness. I mean, consummation, sorry. Death is consummation is the fullness of communion. In this life, I'm fairly limited. If I live in Portland, I cannot be in relationship with my friends in Durham, North Carolina. I'm just limited that way. I mean, I can email them or I can talk to them on the phone, but I don't see them. The guys who were the groomsmen in my wedding live all over the U.S. now. I'm not in communion with them in the same way. Death is consummation. Death is consummation is the removal of all those limitations so that full communion is available where God is all in all. Those limitations are gone. That, in fact, it seems to me, is what Paul was looking forward to. But, okay, so with all of that said, let me move on here. Death is consummation. That final one. Here's what we said 2 weeks ago. Death is consummation was always intended for us. Remember we asked that question, was there death before sin entered the world? And the question is difficult, and there's a lot of debate about it. But what people have said, what the sort of consensus tends to be is this. There wasn't death as consequence before sin entered the world, but there was something called death as consummation. We were always headed somewhere. We were made to become something. And the way that we entered that, the threshold into it, was death. Death is consummation. The problem is, at this point, after sin, we have no idea what death as consummation would have looked like without death as consequence. They're mingled together now. I don't know what it's like for my mother to die and enter into full communion with me because it's mingled with death as consequence right now. But before sin, that was what death was. Death was entrance into full communion beyond what we're capable of here in this life. So death as commitment, that second one, it only came about once death as consequence entered the world. Death that's a consequence entered when sin entered the world. When communion was ruptured, death entered the world. There was a shift in the very order of reality. And communion was broken. So death as commitment entered the world so we could repair that. And then Jesus comes and dies and rises again, and death as consummation is restored to us. The problem is, between Jesus' resurrection and our resurrection someday, that first death, death as consequence that ends communion, and death as consummation that's the fullness of communion, they overlap together. They happen together. So there's a sadness to it and a joy to it. And it's weird and it's paradoxical in that way. But for now, that is how it is. Eventually, someday, all three forms of these deaths, death is consequence, the end of communion. Death is commitment, the need to repair relationship. Death is consummation, entrance into the fullness of relationship. Someday, Christian theology says, all three of those deaths will die. Okay, so that's what we talked about last time. And that is a lot. And there, even just explaining it now is a lot. And we went into significant detail 2 weeks ago. So if you're interested in further details, maybe ask me after class. Or even better, at coffee. You know, we can sit down and talk about further details or whatever. We also have a recording, of course, of all the classes. You know, if you want to listen to it on your way to work and think about theology of death or something like that, feel free. Okay. So that was last 2 weeks ago. In my mind, that was a 5-minute summary. On the clock back there, which is stupidly fast, it was 15 minutes. So, oh, goodness. This week we have one guiding question. We talked 2 weeks ago, what is death? Death is a consequence, commitment, consummation. Why is death? Why was there death as consummation in the first place to become what we were always intended to be? Why is there death as commitment? Because death as consequence entered the world. Why is there death as consequence? Because sin entered the world. That was all last week. This week, we ask this. In our theology of death, what actually happens when we die? What is it that happens to us when we die? What does Christian theology say about that? What is beyond death? Which is really a set of three sub-questions. Sub-question number one, what will we be? When we die, what is it that we are? What is my mother who has died? Second, usually it only takes me 3 times. That time it took me 5 pushes of the button. Where do we go? I mean, what are we talking about? When death happens, where are we talking about the dead are? And third question, when does this occur? Right now? In the future? In between? Has it already happened? What? When? Where? These are our questions today. By the way, as a side note, in 2 weeks, I hope we can reflect on questions such as, how then should we respond to all this emotionally, socially, spiritually? What does it mean to befriend death? I'm hoping we can reflect on that a little bit. How does a theology of death impact our life now, prior to death? I mean, what's the point of even studying this? And why should we remember our death daily? Those are questions I hope we can get to in a couple weeks, but those aren't our questions today. These are our questions today. What happens when we die? What will we be? Where do we go? When will all this occur? Here's the issue. Given that all of us are still alive, how could we possibly know the answer to any of this? I mean, it seems a fair question. We're talking about things we have never experienced. So, what in the world is there to say about this? A couple weeks ago, we talked about Ezekiel. Remember that passage from Ezekiel 37? God says to Ezekiel, mortal, can these dry bones live? You know, the question of life. Can the dead live? And remember Ezekiel's response? Ezekiel says, Lord, you know. Meaning, I have no idea. You tell me, because I don't know. This week, we have a similar phrase that will remind us to have a bit of humility as we enter into these conversations. We are talking beyond what any of us have experienced. So, in 1 Corinthians 15, which is a central passage, and we're going to read a chunk of it today. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says this. Look, he's talking to the Corinthians about death, what happens at death. And he says, look, I'm talking to you about a mystery. This is ultimately a mystery. So, despite the fact that I will speak with confidence today about all of these things, we will remember this. This is ultimately a mystery. And we're doing our best with the information available to us. So we enter into this with humility and through a glass darkly. But if it's such a mystery, what then are we supposed to say? I mean, what can we really know? How can we actually know? And the answer to that question, as you've heard me say several times already as we've talked about a theology of death, the answer to that question, how will we know? Well, it's the same way we know anything about anything. It is the Sunday school answer. How do we know any of this? Jesus Christ. That's how we know the limited information we know. 1 Corinthians 15:20 reminds us of this. Christ has been raised from the dead, and he is the first fruits of those who have died. First fruits is terminology of at the harvest, at the beginning. You have the very first and most important fruits that are offered up to God. And then later on, there's entire harvest. But until that entire harvest occurs, there's just the first fruits. The first fruits is Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, who has died and is our only access to any of this information. For Christian theology, that is what we say. So what we can focus on is this. We pay attention to what we see in Jesus. And the first thing we notice about Jesus, in fact, the striking first thing we notice about Jesus in his post-death life is this. There's absolutely no information whatsoever available to us about his actual resurrection. Have you ever noticed that? There's not one word about the actual moment of resurrection for Jesus. Not one gospel even attempts to say a word about it. All of the gospels are completely silent on the process of resurrection itself because that remains an utter mystery. So it's important to bear that in mind. We are speaking about mystery. We do not know fully what we are talking about here. But with that said, what we can focus on is what we see in Jesus after the resurrection occurs. We don't understand the resurrection moment at all. We have zero evidence, not one bit of information. What we do have is what happens after the resurrection. So let me ask you this. What do we see in Jesus' post-death life? If he's where we get our information, what do we see there? What do we learn by paying attention to the first fruits of resurrection? To the post-death Jesus. Maybe just think on that for a moment. You don't have to say it out loud. I'm just saying, just think for a moment. What do we see in Jesus? Here are at least a few things that come to mind for me, and see if they resonate with you. Perhaps you'll have others as well. Here's something we notice about the post-death Jesus. He appears in different places almost simultaneously. One moment he's in Emmaus, the next moment he's walking through a wall in a locked room in Jerusalem. Almost simultaneously, this is occurring. That's something we notice about the post-death Jesus. He appears to multiple people, multiple times, in multiple locations, and time doesn't seem to be a factor. He eats, remember? He's on the seashore, and there's fish, and he takes some in. He eats, so there's something solid about him. In other words, he's embodied. At the same time, he walks through walls. So there's something rather porous about this person. He's recognizable. They know it's him. And yet somehow, unrecognizable. They're not sure it's him. He disappears at times and then reappears almost at will, it seems. He ascends. Remember this moment in Acts 1? He ascends, meaning he sits with God, unites with God, and is somehow now present to everyone in a way he wasn't previously present to everyone. His body, the body that he has there on the seashore and in the upper room and on the road to Emmaus, it resembles his pre-death body. There's scar marks, apparently. So in some way, it resembles it. But it's also different somehow. Remember Mary, his closest friend, thought he was a gardener. She turned around and she thought he was a gardener. The people on Emmaus, the disciples who were weeping over his death, they thought he was a stranger. In other words, and I suppose here's the point, for the post-death Jesus, time and space and materiality, they're definitely factors, but they are no longer factors in the way that they once were. That's what we notice about Jesus. He seems to have what one theologian calls a, this term is not important, but let me just share it with you. He seems to have what one theologian calls a transphysical body. Transphysical body. Time, space, materiality simply do not function for him in the way that they used to, in the way they function for you and for me. And because of this, his life is no longer limited in the way that it once was. He's passed through the death of consummation somehow, who knows? And his life is no longer limited in the way that it once was. Communion, relationship, is now available to Jesus in a way that was once impossible with others and with God. And all of that, I suppose here's the main point, all of that, we are told, is that Jesus is the first fruits of what is to come for everyone. How do we know what we will be? Well, the answer is, same answer as everything, Jesus Christ. We pay attention and see what we learn. So, with all that said, with that in mind, let us begin. I say begin, we're half an hour in, but let us continue with our question for the day. With the easiest of the three sub-questions. The questions actually get harder as they go down that list. Here's the easiest of the three sub-questions. What happens when we die? What will we be? Here's Christian theology's answer to that. When we die, what will we be? Christian theology's answer to that, of course, remembering Christ is the first fruits of those who have died. What will we be? Now, to reflect on that, what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to share with us a short passage from 1 Corinthians 15 to help us reflect on this, because it offers a striking analogy that both reminds us of the mystery and gives us some clue about what Christian theology says happens when we die, what we will be when we die. It's an analogy, interestingly, and this is just a coincidence, that builds on an analogy Jesus first used in our gospel passage for this morning from John chapter 12. A wonderful cosmic coincidence there. So, listen to this passage and see if you get a sense of the extraordinary analogy that Paul offers up in response to the question, what will we be? This is from 1 Corinthians 15, 35 through 38. But someone will ask, Paul writes, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? Which is, of course, precisely our question. What will we be? And note that right away, Paul's words presumes that this post-death us is embodied. And that's important, because something like three-quarters of all Christians presume it's immaterial. This is not what Paul is saying at all. So note right away that Paul presumes whatever will be, it will be embodied. With what sort of body do they come? But we'll come back to that in a minute. And to this question, Paul replies with this. Here's the nice way to put it. Do not be unwise about this. In Greek, it's actually a one word. It's the word fool, exclamation point, which is funny. This is how strongly Paul takes embodiment to be a key element to what happens to us after death. The Corinthians were saying, oh yeah, what kind of body are we going to have? And Paul says, fool! Nicely, he says, don't be unwise about this. Be wise about this. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And as for what you sow, you do not sow the body that is to be. Rather, you sow a bare seed, perhaps of wheat or some other grain, And here is where he builds on Jesus' analogy from John chapter 12, which we'll read later today. But God gives it a body as God has chosen. That is, by God's grace, by God's will, by God's power, not something inherent within us, just as God has chosen. And I wonder if you caught all that, because it is a wonderfully suggestive way to imagine what we will be after death. Our current life, Paul says, is like a seed. And seeds are, of course, good. As every gardener, as every farmer knows, seeds are good. They are essential. They are worth caring for. But seeds for the gardener are never ultimately the end goal. Seeds are not what the seeds themselves are destined for. Rather, something more is coming from those seeds. Again, not to say they're not important. They are essential. We must care for them. They're just not what that seed is aimed at. Paul then says, the world all around us, creation as we know it, this world is like, well, it's like the soil in which a seed rests. And soil, of course, is fairly limiting. To follow the analogy, the seed in the soil is below ground, of course, right? It's in the dark. It's confined to some degree in that space that it's planted in. But again, the soil is, of course, good, very good, rich, essential. Paul says, you right now, you're that seed. This world is the soil. All of it's good, essential, worth our care and love. But he goes on to say, neither the seed nor the soil is the end goal. And so, as he says, and again, here's his most important claim, what we're ultimately destined for is not to remain the seed that we are now, the seed in the soil, but to die. You were made to die, to your seedness itself. And by dying to our seedness, that state of being a seed, to rise up out of the soil into the air and sun and sky like a plant or a tree. Again, this is all analogy, right? To rise up from that soil into the air and the sun and sky like a plant or a tree. Which, by the way, I find an extraordinary description of what death and life is like. Is really remarkable. But if it is such a mystery, as Paul suggests to us, what then does this tell us about death? What does his analogy tell us about death? If we had more time, I think I'd pause and just ask you what comes to mind as you think of your life now as a seed planted in the soil that is meant to, in some way, break through that soil to become a plant, transformed into a tree. You remember that time, I think it was Linda, where you had an acorn seed or something up here, and she said, this becomes that huge tree out there that looks nothing like this, but that tree could not have been were it not for this. What does that tell you about life and about where we're headed and about death in between? And what we will be. Well, to use the categories we learned a couple weeks ago, death as consequence, the bad form of death that hurts communion, that hurts relationship, death as consequence in this analogy is kind of like a seed that never grows, which Lisa and I experienced. We planted a garden. First time we ever did it in Iowa, knew nothing about what we were doing. I mean, she grew up on a farm, so I don't know. And nothing came up. The seeds died in the soil. That's death as consequence. Whatever that is, that's death as consequence. Death as commitment is the seed that refuses the toxin and welcomes in the moisture and the soil and the nutrients that it needs to grow. That's death as commitment. Death as consummation is a seed that somehow, who knows how? The acorn seed, who knows how, pushes through the soil to the air and the sun and the sky above and becomes something you could not have imagined from that little seed. That's death as consummation. The seed is limited in the soil, but those limitations are removed once that seed comes up and becomes the plant and breaks through the soil into the glorious new life for which it was always intended. Again, Paul's analogy here, I think, is an extraordinary one, helpful for imagining what it is we will be. But our question would then be, why use this analogy in the first place? I mean, why not just tell us exactly what we're going to be? Why use an analogy of a seed that becomes a tree or a plant? Why not just say what we're going to be? And the answer, again, and this is important, crucial, in fact, the reason Paul can't say more than the analogy is because of this. We simply do not have the capacity at this point to understand what that would be. Do you remember a guy named Edward Abbott Abbott? I don't know why his middle name is the same as his last name, but a guy named Edward Abbott Abbott. He wrote a book called Flatland. Does that sound familiar at all? Flatland. It's a story about a two-dimensional thing, creature, being, who encounters a three-dimensional thing, creature, being. The two encounter one another on a two-dimensional plane. The three-dimensional creature says, "Hey, I'm three-dimensional." The two-dimensional creature says, "I don't know what you're saying. I don't know what you're talking about." And he says, "Well, look up." And the two-dimensional creature says, "What's up? I don't know what up is. I know left, I know right, I know forward, I know backward. What in the world is up?" And the three-dimensional creature said, "Well, just turn your head up." And he said, there's no such thing as up. And all the two-dimensional creatures got together and they persecuted the three-dimensional creature for even saying that heretical stuff about an up. No one could see it. No one knew about it. They were two-dimensional creatures. There was no capacity for them to understand some third dimension. It just simply made no sense. The twist in the story is that one of the two-dimensional creatures then goes and meets a one-dimensional creature and then has the same problem. And the three-dimensional creature meets a four-dimensional creature and tries to explain it. The point is something like this. Paul uses an analogy because it's like we're two-dimensional creatures attempting to imagine a three-dimensional world. What does it mean to be you, to be Roger, embodied, but not limited by time and space and material? I don't know. I don't have the capacity to understand what that means. How can I be an embodied thing that's not limited by time and space? How can I be an embodied thing that's not limited by materiality? None of that makes sense to me. Just like three dimensions does not make sense to a two-dimensional creature. So Paul uses an analogy. And he says, I don't know. I'm telling you a mystery. But it's something like this. You're like a seed in soil. That's your life now in this world. You will be a tree. It's like the seed, but it's not. It's from the seed, but it's different. It's the same and yet not the same. Recognizable and unrecognizable. Unlimited in some way, but how can we explain it? I don't know. So Paul uses an analogy. He says, you want to know what you'll be? Here's the best I got. Because we simply do not have the capacity to fully understand what we will be, but it is something like this. And so Paul continues with this. Let me continue in 1 Corinthians 15, 42 through 53. So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable. What is raised is somehow imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. He's talking about the consequences of sin. But it is raised in glory. It's sown in a weakness of sort, but it's raised in power. When it is sown, now hear this, when it is sown, it embodies the soul. When it is raised, it embodies the spirit. It is somehow still embodied. But what in the world does it mean to embody the spirit? I don't know. But somehow, this is what it is. If the soul has its own embodiment, so does the spirit have its own embodiment. Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. But it's not the spiritual embodiment that's first. It's the physical embodiment, the seed, and then the spiritual, the tree. The first man was from the earth, made of dust, soil. The second man is from heaven. As one of dust, so are those who are of the dust. As one of heaven, so are those who are of heaven. Just as we have borne the image of the one of dust, we will also bear the image of the one of heaven. What I am saying, brothers and sisters, is this. Paul has to say that because he's confusing. What I'm trying to say, brothers and sisters, is this. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Oh, look, I tell you a mystery. We will not all die, but we will all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For the perishable body must put on imperishability, and this mortal body must put on immortality. What happens when we die? What will we be? What does Christian theology say about this in its theology of death? We'll be resurrected bodies of some sort. We are now seeds, quote, we will be trees, whatever that might mean. The age we live in is soil. The new age to come, already present in Jesus, is sun and sky. Beyond that, it's a mystery. Look, I'm talking about a mystery here. The key point being, what we will be is embodied. In some way similar and in some way different from what we are now. And the only way from here to there is death. Okay, so that's the easy one of the three. That's the simplest one of the three. We're not going to have time for all of them, but let me just at least introduce this. Sub-question number two. Where do these seeds become trees exist? Because I don't see them. Where do we go? I mean, what happens when we die? Where do we go? Where are the dead? Where are your loved ones? Where are those who lived 1,000 years ago? People whose books we read that we'd love to talk to. Where are these people? Where are the people from every time and place? Where is everyone? The 96 billion, they say, that have lived and died. Where are these people? Well, as it turns out, to answer that one, we also have to answer the third sub-question. When does this occur? And here's what I'd like to say, at least by way of introduction. What does Christian theology say about death when it comes to the question, where do we go? Spoiler alert. If you don't want to know the conclusion, plug your ears now. Spoiler alert. We do not go to heaven. That is not where we go according to Christian theology. At least not in the way we normally suggest. Not immediately, and not any point in the future. But don't worry. That is actually very good news for you. We do not go to heaven. And that is actually very good news for you. But what in the world does that even mean? What do you mean we don't go to heaven? I thought that's the whole point. We're going to sing a song today that says, when we all get to heaven. It's in the song today, I noticed, when the worship team was singing. And the language isn't bad. I don't mean to criticize the language. I just mean to say, theologically speaking, that's not actually what the best of Christian theology has always said. We don't go to heaven. So what happens when we die? I mean, where do we go? And when do we go or get there? Whatever happens, where and when does all this occur? Well, unsurprisingly, in the first century, people were already very confused about all this. And we can understand why. Because it's confusing. Because we're talking about a mystery. So, in the first century, people were told the dead had already been resurrected. That was sort of a common thing that was going around. To which 1 Timothy 2:18 reminds us, no. The resurrection of the dead has most certainly not taken place. At least not yet. The first fruits in Jesus, but not the rest, according to the best evidence we have. So what then are we supposed to know about where and when all of this is occurring? I mean, if that is true, what are we to make of passages like Luke 23:43? I wonder if you remember this one. Jesus is hanging on the cross, and a thief next to him says, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And do you recall what Jesus replied? He promised that thief, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." You remember him saying this? But if the resurrection has not yet occurred, then what is that comment all about? I mean, here's the obvious problem. We see Jesus resurrected, but that thief's body remained in the grave. And if what we are in resurrection is an embodied being, then why did Jesus say, "Today you will be with me in paradise"? If in fact the resurrection has not yet occurred, the thief's body remains in the grave along with every other human we've ever known. It remains in the grave. So what is going on? Was this one of those moments where you say a little fib to someone who's dying to make them feel better? Or are we missing something here? Where are the dead? And Christian theology has suggested, yes, we're actually missing something extremely important here. But for that, you have to come back on the 31st. Because we're not going to have time to it. So here's what we're going to try and do. We're going to try and answer this question. If we have a sense of what we will be, the seed to tree analogy, if that's what death is, if death is necessary, you must die for the seed to become the tree, whatever that means. Well, the question is, where are we talking about? And when are we talking about this? And if the answer is you don't go to heaven, what then is the answer that Christian theology has offered up? That's what I hope to tell you next time. So, okay, thanks everyone. Appreciate your time, and we'll see you back in 8 minutes here. Yeah.